I was born ready.
Let's roll this, bitch. So, you actually posed a very interesting question to me.
Well, I mean, naturally, I wanted to know if it would cost $10 or $15 for a hand job.
Well, I think that that's a that's a very good question. And considering my calluses, I'm actually doing them for $7.50. Oh. But you posed a question to me the other day, and you asked me, like, if I had essentially a Mount Rushmore of stand-up.
And I was speaking strictly stand-up, not entertainers or prop guys.
Right. Not
stand-up.
Just pure.
The man and a microphone.
And I'll tell you, that's actually such a challenging question. It really is. It's a challenging It's a challenging question because, again, you like to restrict these instead of doing like top 10s or even top 20s. You like
that, of the Mount Rushmore.
You get
four.
You get four.
And that's why I try to make it a very specific path. I'm sure asking you Mount Rushmore of stand-up is like asking me for a Mount Rushmore of bass players or drummers.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, obviously, I'm very, very, and I always have been from an incredibly young age, fascinated with stand-up comedy. So, it really becomes a thing where the more I thought about it, the more I realized there's really no way to answer that without pushing aside some really, really brilliant comics. And so what so what I would say is. I will answer what I think the Mount Rushmore of stand-up would be, but I think that there's also discussion to be had on, let's call it honorable mentions, okay? Because, look, you can't go from, you know, Lenny Bruce to today and honestly pick four that tick every box of pure stand-up. So as an example, right, clearly...
Well, I think what you would actually... I could see you having to do is pick a Mount Rushmore for each decade.
Yeah, that would be easier, but I'm not going to puss out like that, all right? I'm going to actually break it down into... Because I think that that's... You know, I think the question's legit, and I think to just wimp out on it, it doesn't work. So I'd like to do several Mount Rushmores, but then basically say, but this would be the final product. So consider this. This is the meeting ahead of time where they're trying to figure out who's going to be on there, and they're breaking them down into categories.
Before we go any further, did you hear that yelp?
No.
Okay. I didn't know if that was... captured on my microphone.
No,
my big dog yelped as I moved my foot and startled.
So there's, and again, this becomes a difficult thing because if you look at the last 70 years, 80 years, you know, you got, obviously, in my opinion, you start off with Lenny Bruce. And the reason you start off with Lenny Bruce is because he started doing it in a way that wasn't being done. So prior to Lenny Bruce specifically, you didn't have people, they were doing vaudevillian jokes. They were doing jokes. They were doing things that you could easily remember the joke and tell the joke at the water cooler. But it wasn't personal. It wasn't about their life. There was no foul language. There was no, you know, commentary necessarily about society. I mean, there would be, but it wasn't as cutting and as biting as Lenny Bruce. So right out of the gate, I look at it, to me, at least in my opinion, Lenny Bruce is the father of modern stand-up. From there, you can easily make direct lines between him and many, many other comics. Now, the only other person that would have been a contemporary, and even that is, I mean, like, you had Richard Pryor and George Carlin, which were they were in the early stages of their career. And as Lenny Bruce came towards the end of his life, these guys, you know, Carlin and Pryor actually kind of took up the mantle in different ways. All right. Carlin obviously was utilizing language. He was utilizing, and now mind you, people don't realize, like, back in the day, Lenny Bruce, the reason why his career went sideways was because of language. So
yeah,
he was getting arrested for obscenities. And George Carlin was not afraid to take up the mantle afterwards. Many people thought George Carlin was like the next incantation of Lenny Bruce in many ways. Richard Pryor was a whole different thing. Richard Pryor was unique unto himself. He was doing things that never had been done. So right out of the gate, it seems almost obvious that you go Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, and Richard Pryor. And you could leave fourth one open with opportunity for other people, because you could still then even go at that time, you know, in that kind of time frame of the, you know, 60s, early 70s, you had Cosby, all right? And I think he gets disqualified, not because of talent, not because of what he's put into the game, not because of what he's brought to stand up, none of those reasons. Obviously, his legal issues and sexual assault issues. And again, I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems like there's been overwhelming evidence that it is true. He obviously did time for it. And that's a shame, because he was America's dad forever. You know what I mean? So yeah, here you have Cosby in the Cosby Show, who reinvented what it meant to be a black professional in the United States, and was setting such an example for everyone as far as what family life should be.
In the 80s, sitcom primetime television did not get the adrenaline needle to the heart until Cosby came along.
Well,
mid-80s.
Cosby,
he really was America's dad.
What he did, and people don't realize this, I don't think, or maybe they do, but they forgot. What he did was he made, and I believe it was Thursday night, he made that must-see correct TV, all right?
Yep.
So you had this powerhouse of a comedian who was putting up at least a facade of high moral ground. This is why I always have a problem with people that seem a little bit too high on the moral ground, is because it always seems like that the more that they try to tell you how to live your life, the worse their actual secrets are, you know. And I don't know what that's about, but that to me was very disturbing. Okay, so I think Cosby gets axed from Mount Rushmore because of that. Had that not happened, definitively Cosby would have been Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby. That would have been it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But with that being said, if I'm going to try to stay within kind of that time frame, Bob Newhart.
I love Bob.
Bob Newhart as a stand-up comic. Most people have not heard the button-down mind of Bob Newhart. And I would argue that it may be one of the greatest comedy albums created. Okay? Now, the bigger thing is most people don't realize that wasn't really, like, he kind of got that on the fly and really wasn't prepared for that, to put that amount of material out. So he worked on it, and did it, and it was this huge success. I think he got a Grammy for it, if not a couple of Grammys, for spoken word. He had a way. So that would be kind of my starting point. I think that, when you look at that, you're talking Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, and Bob Newhart. All right. Now, let's change that up a little bit. Okay. And let's look at it from the point of view of Unfortunately, in that list, there's no women. Now, a lot of people will tell you that, you know, the bottom line is there's just not as many women in stand-up as there are men. There really never has been. However, there were some great women comedians at the time. You know, you're talking Joan Rivers. You're talking Phyllis Diller. You know what I mean? Like, there were some real powerhouse performers.
I can think of one in the 80s that really popped out of the screen in stand-up, early 80s, and that was Judy Tenuta.
Judy Tenuta was, and I've met her, and she was, unfortunately, she's passed, but Judy Tenuta was an incredibly interesting person on mm-hmm. and off stage. She just, there was something about her that there were zero fucks given. She just was going to do her character, and her character was not, like, horrifically far off. I mean, it was a very, very exaggerated example of herself, but my experience mm-hmm. with her was that if you took the flourishes away, you know, you were getting Judy Tenuta. She was amazing. Elaine Boozler, amazing.
Yes.
You know, there's, you know, God, I mean, you can go, you know, like if you keep going down the line there, you just have a bunch of women that are just hysterical, whether it's Margaret Cho, whether you're talking Roseanne, Janine Garofalo, Moms Mabley, you know, the list literally goes on and on. Amy Schumer, Sarah Silverman, Lily Tomlin, you know what I mean? But Lily Tomlin wasn't necessarily a stand-up, you know what I mean? Like, she, I think, did some. Wanda Sykes. Yeah, Wanda Sykes is brilliant.
Yeah.
And
this day, she's hysterical.
Doesn't get enough love, doesn't get enough of what she deserves. Now, you had that area, like I said, where if you look at it from the jump point of, and I'm just using that as an example, you know, like 1960 is kind of when you started to see more of what Lenny was doing instead of doing stuff that he thought was just going to get him on TV or whatever. And then you started seeing that also with Carlin and Pryor at the same time. Bob Newhart was a little bit different. But, you know, I mean, big fucking honorable mention to Don Rickles of that period.
Some Don Rickles.
You couldn't get...
Wow, I suddenly went dark in my screen. Oh, there we go.
There's not a Tonight Show appearance that Rickles was on where he didn't slay. Slay.
The one that... You know, there's two that stick out in my mind. The circumstances of him telling the Frank Sinatra story.
Which was hysterical. Yeah.
That is just priceless. And then, of course, when he was filling in for Johnny Carson and broke his cigarette dispenser.
And
told the audience to...
No, don't tell. Yeah, don't tell Johnny.
And then the next night, Johnny went to get a cigarette and it just fell apart. And the audience starts cracking up, and Johnny finds out Don Rickles broke it, and then confronted Don, who was across the hall filming his TV show. That was priceless.
It was priceless, because you never saw that
Johnny
shit before.
Walked in the middle of shooting the sitcom, Don just, you could see him turn a little red and just crack up, was like, oh, I'm caught.
Yeah, exactly. So to me, again, with the highest level of esteem being the four that are on Mount Rushmore, I find the honorable mentions are just super important. You know what I mean? It doesn't take away from, if they didn't make it. So let's say, for example, Phyllis Diller, okay? Mm-hmm. She was unique unto herself. There's no two ways about it. Always funny. Same with Joan Rivers. Always funny. But when I'm comparing Joan Rivers to Pryor, Carlin, or Newhart, I don't see that she hits that next level. There's something about those guys that is...
Entire terms, fourth or fifth gear.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So like... And I get it, too. Like, if you listen to Lenny Bruce today, 99% of it doesn't hold up. You know what I mean? So like you could argue he needs to come off the list because it doesn't hold up. Whereas you could listen to Carlin, you could listen to Newhart, and you can listen to Pryor, and they hold up. But even if you break it down further, of those four, really, just Carlin and Newhart hold up the best. Pryor holds up, but I don't think Pryor holds up as good as Carlin holds up. And it's not to say that Carlin's better than Pryor. It's just the material. And when I say holds up, I mean the material, no matter what decade you're in, you can find funny.
You can find funny, or you can identify.
Yeah, you can identify with it. It's something that's universal. And I think when you move forward into the 70s, again, you find Carlin and Pryor at the top of that list. So if we just do the 60s, you got them at the top. If we do the 70s, you still got Carlin, Pryor, and Newhart killing it. Yep. Now they're going in different directions, though. Carlin stays with stand-up. Pryor starts to do some movies. And Newhart starts to do the Newhart Show. And I can't remember when the Newhart Show came out, but I believe it was in the 70s and then lasted into early 80s. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
Well, there were different shows. It was Bob Newhart or the Newhart Show.
Yeah, the Newhart Show, then you had Bob Newhart.
Yeah, and then there was Newhart, where he was the caretaker, the owner of the
right, B&B. And he brilliantly brought that back to Newhart, where Bob Newhart probably had the best final episode in the history of television, because at the end of the Bob Newhart Show, he woke up from a dream. He was in the old sitcom now, in his bed with his wife from that sitcom, Plachette, and you had him just basically go, "I had the weirdest dream. I owned a bed and breakfast in Vermont," which is just ridiculous, and it was so well done. The writing was always tight. His performance was always tight. Again, Newhart is one of those guys who does not get the immediate thought or the immediate love that he deserves. But what a brilliant comedian. So now if you move that into the 70s, like I said, you still have Carlin killing it. You still have Pryor killing it.
I got to ask you, did you see any of the Newhart stuff on The Big Bang Theory?
Yes. Yeah, like that's the thing is
brilliant.
He was able to come back as a guest and be, you know, a reoccurring guest and be brilliant.
Yeah. Perennial straight man.
Yeah, just so then you had, you know, in the 70s you had, again, your powerhouses were, you know, Carlin, Pryor, you know, Paul Mooney, another guy does not get the respect he deserves. Paul Mooney was and is as brilliant gets. However, again,
you know who I want to talk about, individuals who don't, I hate saying it, but kind of the forgotten guys from the 60s, like Foster Brooks.
Yeah. Well,
Rowan and Martin.
You got Foster Brooks, you got Rowan and Martin, but the big one that was lost in all that and always has been Nipsey. Lost. Nipsey, another one.
Yeah.
But, again, you could go back to Dick Gregory. You could go back to Mort Saul. But to me, the big one?
Yeah.
Jonathan Winters.
Oh, amazing. Brilliant guy.
But no one really, I mean, like he had his thing, right? And then really had his reintroduction to everyone on Mork and Mindy. And, but to see him just riff or to see him improv back and forth with Robin Williams, that's a level of art that transcends stand-up in many, many ways.
Another guy that I'm afraid is going to get forgotten to the annals of time, big in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. One of my personal favorites, Mr. Rodney Dangerfield.
See, I don't think he gets forgotten. I don't think he gets forgotten. And the main reason is not just what he did as a comedian. Okay.
His movies.
Not just because of his movies. What he did for which
was go see Back to School.
Oh yeah, it's a great movie. Okay, but
fantastic.
But the reason why Rodney doesn't get lost in the mix is not because of his stand up, not because he left stand up for like, I don't know, 10 years or whatever, and then came back in his 40s and fucking crushed it from the time he came back until he died. It's because he gave back to the comedy community. So you had Dangerfields, which was the club.
Yes.
You had the Rodney Dangerfield Young Comedian specials. He gave credibility to a lot of the guys that I'm going to talk about next or shortly. He gave them their start on a platform that made their careers. You know what I mean? Like if you got a Rodney Dangerfield special, if you were on a Young Comedians special with Rodney Dangerfield, you may not blow up like Kinison did or Dice did, but you're going to have a career the rest of your life. You know what I mean? Like that was a done deal. You basically have a career. And then it's up to you to kind of manipulate it forward. Because there were guys on those shows that were stone cold fucking killers as far as stand-up comics. Robert Schimmel's a stone cold fucking killer. Bobby Slayton, stone cold fucking killer. You know, the list goes on and on. But they weren't Kinison. They weren't Hicks. They weren't Dice.
You know, there's an individual who, as Rodney Dangerfield said, was every bit, if not more brilliant than him, that should have been in the comedy scene because of how quick he was. More in the vein of a Dangerfield or Rickles, but really did not enter that scene was actually Bobby the Brain Heenan in wrestling.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He apparently had been offered a late night show and didn't take it. But yeah, imagine that.
Now, if I can, I want to go back to the 60s and 70s for just a second, because there is a comedic god that we haven't even brought his name up yet. You know,
really?
Yeah, absolute comedic god, Red Fox.
In the 60s. Oh, gosh, yes.
Okay. Red Fox was selling party albums before anyone. I mean, like that was what was happening. You know what I mean? So like you look at kind of you can look at Lenny Bruce and go, he was the father of it. But really, you almost have to put Red Fox next to Lenny Bruce as the father of it, because each of them spawned off their own kind of prodigy of sorts. So like, did Pryor listen to Lenny Bruce? Yeah, he did, but he was probably more influenced by Red Fox. And Carlin was much more influenced by Lenny Bruce than he was Red Fox, but also had that influence. The one of the guys that kind of gets left out is Mort Saul. He just never took it to that next level. I mean, he was always great, you know what I mean? But like you had your Mort Sauls, your Dick Gregory's, your Red Foxes, your Mom's Mabley. I mean, like, these are some just amazing comedians for their time. And whether or not the material holds up to this day or not, they still deserve to be mentioned. You know what I mean? Like that was just such a great time for figuring out what actual stand-up was. So between, you know, like I said, you got your Mom's Mabley, you got Jonathan Winters, Dick Gregory, Mort Saul, Red Fox, you know, Lenny Bruce. And then from that, you're starting, I think really the 70s is where what stand-up was going to become kind of was finding its way. And in that time, you know, you had obviously Robin Williams was coming up doing not just stand up, but also Mork and Mindy, and then eventually moved on into movies and did, I think his first movie was Popeye. And then, like, he struggled with his movies because he really threw himself into it. And if you remember Popeye, he did a fucking amazing job. He did an amazing job. It just was a shitty movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, bad writing.
It was, you know, it was just a shitty movie. But he playing Popeye was amazing. Totally believed it. And I think that that's partially why, even though he had a couple, because I think it was shortly thereafter he had, like, The World According to Garp. He had a couple of rough goes at it in the beginning and then exploded with, you know, your Good Morning Vietnam, all the amazing movies that he did. Mm-hmm. So you see that influence, you know, and you start to see comedy change in the 80s, right? So now you got guys coming up like Eddie Murphy looking back at Pryor and looking back at Red Fox. And no one can tell you, and I don't think Eddie Murphy would say that those two weren't just huge influences on him.
Absolutely.
Eddie Murphy changed the game. And I can't remember if it was, I think it was 83 when Delirious came out.
Yes.
Is that correct?
He was, what, 20 or 22 years old?
He was 22 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insane. 22 years old. Does an HBO special. He's already been on Saturday Night Live. Like,
yep.
What he did from the time he left school, because I don't know if he graduated or not, but he was doing stand-up at 15. Mm-hmm. So by the time he was 22, he had 7 years under his belt, which is typically when a comic is just kind of figuring out who they are and how good they are and what, you know, what they need to work on. They're just starting to, you know, to really, really settle into the position.
Yep.
And he was masterful. I mean, it was literally a masterclass watching Delirious. A masterclass.
He, of course, transitioned beautifully onto film.
Oh.
And some of the movies he made, which were just humongous.
Yeah, you're talking Trading Places, you know what I mean? Beverly Hills Cop. Like, right out of the gate, he was just a juggernaut of box office. And then he went and he did, you know, another special. I don't think that one was as good. I thought it was good, but I thought Delirious was just, it was literally a masterclass. And then he decided not to do stand-up anymore. And I got to be honest with you, I kind of get why. He had all this opportunity and all this money coming in from movies, right? Well, to do stand-up, you got to be on stage every possible night you can be in order to get your next hour. And if you're like Carlin, setting the example of every 2 years or so, every two and a half, 3 years, putting out a new special, that is 100% your job then. That's your dedication. That's where you're spending your time.
I don't know if you know this or not, but with like stand up, it's if you don't do it a lot, you kind of lose that, not just writing, but timing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with comedy and stuff.
So, that's actually true. And you'll hear like guys like Jay Leno. And again, that's another guy that comes out of the 70s. Okay. You got guys like Jay Leno, who even while he was doing The Tonight Show, if he didn't have a gig, he would still do the gig at the Ice House on Sunday night. So this is a motherfucker that's working. Like, typically, from my understanding, Jay's schedule was he would go in, you know, whatever time in the morning for The Tonight Show. He would essentially work on The Tonight Show every single day during the week. And then he would also be working on material that he was going to be doing on Sunday night, for because that was like his gym was the Ice House. But if not, he was getting on a plane after filming The Tonight Show and going doing a gig. So he never even touched his Tonight Show money. He only lived off of his stand-up money, which to me, I got to be honest with you, is something that I look at with great admiration. Now, Jay was a killer back in the day. Fucking absolute assassin on stage. And the downside of him doing The Tonight Show and all the stuff that came with that is that he had to be what they needed. Okay, so he had to be what was necessary for television, not necessarily what was, And it's not like he's a dirty comic or anything like that. You know what I mean? I'm not even saying it from that point of view. I'm saying it from the point of view of he had to kind of walk the line between two sides to keep ratings up. He didn't want to afford to lose anyone. And again, what a brilliant move. He was in this, he had the opportunity, he took it. He saw the writing on the wall and knew how to play his next play. And brilliant, right? Yep. But his comedy did soften, in my opinion, because then he realized, and this is the thing, is in stand-up, where the big money is in corporate gigs. Because you can go in and do an hour and make $100,000 if you're Jay Leno, you know what I mean? Or more, doing Fortune 500 companies week, you know, keynote speaker, and you go up and you do a little bit of time and blah, 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 blah. Next thing you know, you get a $100,000 check. But you have to be corporate. You have to do corporate jokes. You have to know how to navigate that environment. And again, I give him credit for that. Now, the downside is you don't see like a lot of old Jay Leno albums out there. And I don't even know if there are any. You don't have all the old recordings of Jay Leno, but him and Seinfeld kind of fall in the same kind of thinking. They're like, Seinfeld has obviously done some specials, but Leno has always been, well, why should I do that and get a check when I can continuously do this material and never have it cashed out because I did it in a special? So he's got a large, large volume. I mean, because he never stopped writing, but he never gave it away in a special either. And that's the thing is, like, you know, Carlin kind of set, like, if I'm not mistaken, the very, very first HBO special was Robert Klein. And I'd be willing to put money on it that Robert Klein was the very first HBO special. And then came Carlin. So you had Klein and Carlin kind of leading the way on the HBO specials, which was essentially the Netflix comedy specials of that day. So they saw that this was a new opportunity, and they saw that they weren't going to be restricted in their language, and that they were both very language oriented. Not necessarily, when I say language, I don't mean they had to say bad words in order to be funny, but they played with words. They wanted the word play. And by necessity, they needed the opportunity to use the more colorful language. But it was always done in this very interesting and unique way. But Carlin kind of kept going. You know what I mean? I think Robert Klein did 3 or 4 specials, and don't hold me to that. I know he did it more than one with HBO. And I can't remember if it was 2 or 4 or somewhere in between. I don't remember. But Carlin had how many? What, like 14 or something ridiculous?
Yeah, it was like 14 or 16.
I don't think it was 16, but I mean, like, he made a career of that.
Yeah. Every couple of years.
Every
another one.
Two and a half years, man. It was almost like clockwork, you know?
Yep.
And in that time.
And you also have to think about his, you know, let's say it's 14. I think it is 14 specials, but every single one was must see.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, as soon as it was advertised, I was absolutely geeked and couldn't wait for it.
Drop a link tape into the VHS player.
Yeah. Well, I mean, record. Look, you know, you're talking, you know, and you know this, but you're talking to somebody who couldn't remember the capitals to the 50 states, but had memorized the list of dirty words from Carlin at Carnegie. You know, like, he was a huge, huge influence in my view of what stand-up could and should be.
Speaking really quickly, I know this is off topic, but you just said a magic word there, and I've got a question for you. You've been to New York City, right?
Yeah.
I have to pick a deli to go to. Carnegie Deli or Katz Deli?
You know, I gotta tell you, I've never been to either.
Oh, really?
No, I've never been to either. But based on guys that I know, I would say that you go to cats. That would be my guess.
Okay.
And if you can do it, both. Because I mean, it's almost a coin toss. You know what I mean?
Like, I'm having that problem of, Christ, which one do I go to?
Well, here's my play, okay? You go there to each of them, all right? And you order a half sandwich and maybe a bowl of soup or something, right? So you go, say, 11, in between 11 and 1 to the first deli, and then 3 to 4, you hit the next deli. I think when you're talking those two institutions, you almost have to make room in your belly for both. And then you make your own decision. Again, you're talking two institutions.
Yeah, that's my issue. And now that you say that, I think we're going to spend the night. So maybe I'll do one day, one the next day, because dinner is going to be at this place where they don't have any chefs. It's always somebody's grandmother.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah. And the menu changes daily because there's a different grandmother that comes in.
Like
old school.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah. Cooking family meals.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, that's the way that the Seinfeld show started. So like when Jerry had the opportunity for the meeting with NBC, he's told the story a million times. He didn't have anything. He didn't have any ideas. He had already done the Tonight Show like, I don't know, 9 or 11 times and killed it every time. And no one had reached out to him and been like, hey, maybe we should offer a show to this kid. So
the show about nothing.
So when they did, okay, he's like, no, I've got nothing. I got no ideas. I got nothing. And he goes, I thought this was to me, the whole point was just to have the meeting. And then he was talking with Larry David after they had done sets. I don't know where they had done sets. It might have been at the Cellar. I'm not sure. But they ended up at a deli afterwards. And they're just being two comics sitting in a deli, like, you know, going back and forth, making fun of shit, talking silly, you know, ripping on shit or whatever. And Larry David said, that's what the show should be about. Just essentially the dissection of the world through a comic's eyes and the silliness of it. And that's the thing is again, when you're talking about Mount Rushmore, how do you not have Seinfeld? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
well, again, it's going to come down to decades.
I don't know. Well, again, I still think that that's kind of a cheap way out. And I don't want to do that because I think that, like I said, if you look at Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Bob Newhart, the only one, in my opinion, that you could almost remove from that, and it crushes me to say this, is Lenny Bruce, because if you listen to his material today, just unless you're putting yourself in the mindset of what culture was when he was doing this material. Like it seems very, you know, milquetoast in comparison to, like if you compare Lenny Bruce to Sam Kinison, you think, well, Kinison is just a monster comparatively. But the fact of the matter is that's who Kinison was influenced by, was Lenny Bruce. Like the vast majority of edgy comedians were influenced by Lenny Bruce because they were looking back, they were listening to it through either their time and it was still valid, or they were listening to it with a little bit easier opportunity to imagine what the circumstances were at that time and why that made it funny and why that was risky and why that was like outrageous that he did what he did. So, I mean, again, like, yeah, you can do it by decades, but I really think, like, the only one that I could flip-flop on would be Lenny Bruce and Red Fox. You know what I mean? But I do think Lenny kind of laid the groundwork in a different way than Red Fox did. So that's why I lean towards Lenny. Now, if you move...
Well, let me ask you this. Who's the king of the mountain? The slugfest between Pryor, Carla?
Oh, God. Well, there's two different things that you have to take in consideration with if it's death match, you know, in the octagon between Carlin and Pryor. It's very difficult because you had Pryor. So you got Carlin, who was born in 37 and died in 2008. You got Pryor, who was born in 40 and died in 05. If you take them at their peaks, okay, and when I say that, I would say that that's like Richard Pryor here and now versus Carlin at Carnegie, okay, or Pryor live on Sunset Strip and Carlin. I think Carlin at Carnegie was a defining moment for Carlin. I think that that was really one of his strongest broad appeal. All right. As he got older, he got a little bit more cranky and a little bit more. I loved it. I always loved what he was doing. But there was.
Yeah, he was always a lot of fun when he's pissed off.
Right. I always found that to me, like the guy who's just had enough, who's just fucking had enough. That to me was always what I identified with. Like, I'm not trying to be a dick, but I've had enough. Fuck off. This is crazy. That to me was always very appealing because it's the every man who sees it for what it is and then just has enough and loses his shit.
I don't have to worry about dying because I'll just pass away.
Yeah. So, again, this is a very difficult one. I personally, like if I'm comparing what I think is Carlin's greatest work to Pryor's greatest work, I'm going to compare Carnegie Hall to Live on Sunset. And in doing so, Pryor wins.
Mm.
If I compare their careers, Carlin wins. So if I compare their overall, and there's a lot of albums that Pryor put out that people don't know about. A lot. Like, I was shocked at how many albums he had put out. He just didn't put out a lot of specials. So you had like Live at Sunset, you had Here and Now, which were basically his concert films. Yeah, that's a tough one because I think Carlin would say, you know, because they were friends. They were tight. Yeah. They were good friends. I think, and they were both kind of popping, you know, one would pop a little and then the other one pop a little and the other one pop a little and they kept going, you know, up the ladder together. I think Carlin would say in the most loving way, he would probably go, Richie was better. Say what you will, but Richie was better. And I think Pryor would say that he was better, that Carlin was better. I don't know that those two can be compared because what they brought to the table was just
different.
It was just different and it was unique and it was unique unto themselves. And I think that they each had a little bit of jealousy for the ability of the storyline or the storytelling or the joke placement or the setups. Like they each, you know, Pryor was talking about characters and doing characters from his life growing up, living in a brothel in Peoria, Illinois. Carlin was talking, you know, and came from as bad of a childhood as Pryor did in many ways, you know, alcoholic father, him and his brother and his mother. You know, like he was very, very young when his mother was like, nope, we're done. Like his uncle was waiting at the bottom of a fire escape in New York City somewhere to whisk her away. She came down the fire escape with the kids and whatever she could carry, you know, like while this guy was passed out drunk or whatever. And then just fucking adios. Carlin grew up in, you know, rough neighborhoods. Carlin was always, you know, dealing with fights. He was dealing with criminals. He was being a criminal at times. So there was all these things that they had that in their childhood, which helped form who they were as comedians. But with Carlin, his mother was very, very focused on language and vocabulary and communication. And so for Carlin, it was, I want to be Danny Kaye. I want to get to that level. Well, how can I do that? Well, I can do that by doing radio. And then he becomes a partner with a guy, and then they move, and, you know, like, eventually they split, and he goes one way, and the guy, other guy goes the other way. Pryor was always kind of like, boom, boom, boom. What can I do to get attention in a positive way? Because it was a way for him to prevent getting hit with a switch, you know? So they both kind of came from this similar shitty, poor background, but developed in different ways. So I think they had a mutual respect for each other that probably did not exist very much at that time between two top-notch comedians. But if you go further, you know, if you go into the 80s, then you've got, I mean, essentially you've got Robin Williams is just a monster of the 80s. Billy Crystal was a monster of the 80s.
That almost ended bad there.
Oh, yeah.
Tried to move the microphone and the whole thing came off.
Oh, shit.
It's like, oh, no.
And again, it kind of depends on what you're talking about, whether you're talking about somebody who is popping at that time or that was solid all the way through. You know,
I just wanted to put you in that uncomfortable position of having to rationalize which of these two is better.
It's
a no-win situation.
It really is a no-win situation. They're both brilliant, but for different reasons. You know what I mean? And if you look even like, God, I mean, again, there's so many. Like we're not.
What would you prefer to have happen? Would you prefer to be eaten by a shark or hit by a bus?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like that. Because, look, in that entire conversation, we've been talking almost an hour about, you know, essentially the 60s and 70s with a little bit of the 80s. And we haven't even brought up Steve Martin.
Yep.
I
was about to bring up Steve Martin earlier.
And again, people forget that this guy changed stand-up in the 70s. Yep. Late 70s, early 80s. He was the first arena act. Like, no one was doing that. No one could do that. And doing it in such an irreverent way. I mean, at that time, you're talking, you had Steve Martin doing Wild and Crazy Guy and all that stuff, and the arrow through the head, and King Tut, and it was silly, and there's no way you could, I mean, how do you get offended? You know what I mean? But here he is, he's selling out these massive, you know, theaters and auditoriums, and then he's just like, nope, I'm done. I'm done doing stand-up. And again, I get it. It's a very, very difficult and taxing lifestyle, even under the best of circumstances. But when you're constantly trying to develop new material, God, it can be brutal. You know, like a lot of the guys you see putting out show after show after show right now, I've got a lot of admiration for, you know what I mean? Like, I look at, you know, Tom Segura as an example. Just consistent. He's just a machine. And I know that sounds funny because his best friend's Bert Kreischer, and Bert goes by the Machine, but both of them are putting out material at a rate that is pretty impressive. Gaffigan is...
I was about to say... Within the last 20 years, really 30 years, there's strong candidates of just
powerhouse producers. Yeah, like, and
Gaffigan, Chappelle, Bill Burr.
Yeah, these are guys that are constantly putting out the goods. And it's not like, yeah, I mean, you might have a hit or miss here or there, but these guys are putting out consistently better material each time. And the level it's awesome to see.
I can't remember his name for the life of me. He's Australian.
Oh, yeah. Oh, shit. Hold on. Yeah, he did a bunch, too. And was...
Jim Norton?
No, Jim Norton's out of New York. Jim Jeffries. Jeffries.
I knew it was a Jim.
I really thought... was going to be almost a reincarnation in an Australian form of Hicks at first. Mm,
I could see that.
Different in his style. I mean, not like he was going for that, but just like there was like a tone to him. You know what I mean? There was just a
There's a feel.
There's a feel that, like, yeah. you go, and I think you do that with every comedian. When you see them for the first time, you go, oh, who does this guy remind me of? Just like every comic starting out emulates their favorite comedians until they find their own voice.
It's the exact same thing with music.
Yeah, I think it's just art in general. But Gaffigan, you want to talk about it. Like, again, you don't have to like him. You don't have to think he's funny. But you cannot deny the longevity. You cannot deny the work ethic. You cannot deny the fact that he's consistently getting better and putting out better material. I see that, like I said, with Segura. I think Segura is just force of nature right now. Chappelle is an absolute force of nature. Louis C.K., one of the most brilliant comedians, I think. Like, I look at Louis and I don't even get how he does it. Like I know how these tricks are done, and I know how hard it is to develop specifically stuff that is edgy. And what Louis has done just consistently, it's a shame that he got into the trouble that he got into. You know what I mean? Because apparently right now there's a video, a sex video of Drake going around. I don't know what the details are on it, but apparently he's either jerking off or whatever, but he's apparently got this fucking huge ass hog, and it's gotten out online. And
so how big is this hog?
I have no idea. Like, I have no idea. Okay. None. This was something I saw on Twitter.
Trying to paint you into the corner.
You're not painting me into that corner, motherfucker. That ain't happening. I saw the story on Twitter. So it was blowing
big
up
enough that you don't think you could handle it.
I'm just saying I'm not even interested in stepping in the room. But here he is online, and instead of it being him being criticized and ostracized and essentially canceled, like Louis did. Okay, so Louis comes out and goes, you know what? I made a mistake. I did stupid shit. I own up to it. I'm apologizing. You know, okay, I'll take whatever comes my way. And it came his way. And he went through some shit with it. Now, I'm not saying it was not justified, and I'm not saying it wasn't justified. Maybe it was, maybe
it
wasn't.
It happened.
I'm just saying it happened. Okay. Now, whatever the consequences were for that, maybe they were too much, maybe they weren't enough. Again, I'm not defending or condemning. All right. But what I will say is that I think it just made him fucking funnier. I think he went into such dark places personally and realized the only way out of it was through writing material, because the material I've heard since then, holy shit, is it good. I mean, unbelievably good. And I don't see any signs of him stopping. I think Louis C.K. in many ways will be as prolific in his content creation as George Carlin, and that's just in stand up. I'm not even talking movies or television or anything like that. I'm just talking stand up. I think that Louis has potentially could be even more prolific than Carlin. But again, Jim Gaffigan, I don't know how many hours he's got that's in the can and recorded, but it's got to be creeping up on 15, 17.
Yeah. Now,
how many specials he has, I don't know off the top of my head. But again, yeah,
I don't know, but there's a lot of material out there.
Well, fucking Chappelle, for Christ's sakes. Chappelle, yeah. This guy, I'm telling you, it's like, I honestly wonder if it would take him more than 3 months to write an entire fucking hour that was just killer. Like, the level of production of material coming out of Chappelle, this is like, you know, and again, we're not even talking like Chris Rock, who's a brilliant comedian. And, you know, yeah, we can talk the scandal, you know, that happened with Will Smith, which to me, I found to be just sad.
Yeah.
Will Smith is a big dude. Chris Rock is not a big dude. It was a joke, and it wasn't even a big, stinging, hardcore joke. just smile, let it go. You just ruined everyone's image of who you are.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Will Smith, and again, I was a Will Smith fan, but I got to tell you, it's hard to watch Will Smith after that, because it's like, okay, you're the guy that lets all of his family problems build up to the point where you lose it publicly. Well, that's fine if you're a sheet metal worker, you know, in New Jersey. But when you're front and center at the Oscars, was it the Oscars? I think it was. Whatever.
And it was a joke that most people didn't even catch because it was so quick.
It was quick. It was subtle. It was a little poke. It was a little poke.
Yeah.
All right. So if we go back to the 80s, that's when you started to see all those different specials come out. That's when they started to overload, whether it was Evening at the Improv, whether, you know, Last or Young Comics, whatever. They had a ton of shows that came out. But the ones that were really creating the next stars, the main one, you either had your own HBO special or you were on Young Comedian Special, Rodney Dangerfield's Young Comedian Special. And
you know, it's interesting, just an observation, but 80s and 90s, TV dads that most people wish that they had, which was in the 80s, there's nobody better than Bill Cosby. Absolutely nobody.
No, he was better. A fantastic TV dad. But
and in the 90s, it was Bob Saget.
Yeah. Oh, Saget's so funny, too. The thing about Saget was, here he was. This was supposed to be his vehicle. This was supposed to be his show. But it became very, very clear that the Olsen twins were stealing the spotlight. So it was supposed to be Saget's show, and he was supposed to be supported by, you know, the other two characters. Danny, what was it?
Dave Coulier.
And John Stamos.
Yeah, John Stamos.
So,
which, did you ever see the pilot with the original dad?
No.
It's horrible.
Who was it? Some nobody or?
Some nobody. I don't know who he was, but it's awful.
But here's the funny part about it, right? So it was supposed to be a vehicle for Saget, and he was supposed to be the star of it. It quickly became this other thing. So the original direction of the writing had to change as well and be more kid-centric, right? And what a lot of people didn't realize, because he wasn't really known for being a comedian, but he was getting all this opportunity with Full House, and then he was doing America's Funniest Home Videos, and they were always writing these stupid jokes for him, and he hated that. He hated all of it, but, I mean, the fucking money that he was making, he was kind of trapped in his own success.
Yep.
But as a comedian, he was one of the dirtiest comedians out there. So he would have these people come to his shows, and he would do his set, and they would walk out. For a long time, they were walking out on him because he was so dirty, and they thought they were going to get, you know, Mr. Full House, America's Funniest Home Videos. And, you know, he's talking about eating assholes. And this is not
the aristocrat's joke.
Yeah, the aristocrat's joke. That actually, I think, broke him out of that more than anything else. So he did the aristocrat's joke, but he also did, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he did kind of a slimy role on Entourage, where he was kind of playing, you know, a little bit more of a slime ball. And I think that actually helped him, because then he was going back out again and prior to, you know, falling and hitting his head and dying, unfortunately, he was kind of seeing a resurgence of interest in what it was he was doing, or at least it seemed that way. But those specials in the late 80s, early 90s, those were the things that gave us, you know, they gave us Kinison, they gave us Hicks, they gave us Dice, you know, they gave us Stephen Wright. They, you know what I mean? Like all these different wonderful, weird creatures. Mitch Hedberg. Mitch, I mean, God, you can't watch Mitch Hedberg and not fucking laugh. I mean, he had such a unique way of doing it. And like, I know a lot of comedians.
A burrito is just a sleeping bag for your meat.
Yeah, I mean, there was tons of things, you know what I mean? And you know, to me, so, that was a great loss. Mitch Hedberg was a big loss. Bill Hicks was a huge loss.
Yeah. Why didn't Dennis Leary put out a second album?
Because Bill Hicks died.
Yeah, there's no cure for cancer.
There's no cure for cancer, yeah. And again, like, even when you look at Leary, Leary always wanted to be an actor, really, anyway.
Yeah.
But I don't fault him for what he did. He found an opportunity, utilized it to the best of his ability, and has made him a fucking amazing career out of it. Not the stand-up career, necessarily, but he had his moment, did his thing, had his character, played it well. And that was when those type of characters were, it was like everyone needed a character. Everyone, you had, you know, that's, I mean, even like Dice. Dice was an impressionist, really. And the Dice Man just happened to be what caught fire. And then he was kind of stuck in that character for a while. And, you know, that was a very limiting character. Not just in general, but limiting for him as far as who he was as a person. Same with Kinison. There was no way that that was going to be much more than a one or two trick pony, because it could only, you could only do that for so long. I think you see that with a number of comedians out of that era. Even if Stephen Wright wanted to do a different delivery, which I don't know that he could or would want to, all right? But again, this is a guy who's a brilliant comedian to this day, but whose name...
His analytical wordsmithing,
yeah,
is just... amazing.
It's top notch, but that's not something that you can, that type of material is not necessarily something you can turn over every 2 years with a new hour. You know, there, sometimes you got to look at it from the point of view, there can only be one Mona Lisa. You know what I mean? There can only be one Catcher in the Rye. Sometimes
Norm,
it's
McDonald.
Oh my God, I fucking love Norm McDonald. I adore Norm McDonald. No one, there was no one, and hasn't been anyone that I can think of that is even near what Norm did. And because of what he did, he had his ups and downs, but it was one of those things where, like, no, that's who he is. He's not changing. That's how he does it. And you're going to like it today and hate it tomorrow. And then you're going to realize you were wrong yesterday. You know what I mean? Just wicked with his, like, he would just do like some of the most amazing, like, dad joke type things, even. And he would just fuck
with
you.
The one that gets me still is the moth joke.
I don't know that I know that one.
I would not do it justice.
I'll look, that's one for everyone to look up.
Look it up.
The moth joke.
Yeah. It is just brilliant.
But now, again, you're in a circumstance where, you know, we're trying to narrow it down, but comedy has gone through so many different highs and lows and niches. There was a period of time where it was very alternative, okay? In the alternative market, you had your Janine Garofalo's, your Margaret Cho's, you can bring that all the way forward to today with, you know, Sarah Silverman in a way. Still brilliant, you know what I mean? And all that kind of came through the late 90s, early 2000s. And I think that that's kind of petered out a little bit, and that's unfortunate. I don't think we can talk about great comedians without bringing up Bernie Mac. Bernie Mac was, again, somebody that was unique unto himself. Billy Connolly. Huh?
Steve Harvey.
I've never been a big Harvey fan, and
yeah,
I hate to say that. I know he's hugely successful
into TV.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he had his audience for that stand up audience. He had a stand up audience for a period of time. I just never
Kevin Hart
again. I mean, like I said, there's just so many. Like, it's easy to like, we've probably listed somewhere between 30 and 40 comedians at this point. And that's not even touching that's just off the top of the head. That's just scratching the surface. You know what I mean? Like, so God, that's difficult.
One that a lot of people don't mention, and for some reason I used to giggle watching him, was Emo Phillips.
Emo, he did the pudding joke. Something mm-hmm. about sitting naked in pudding. And it was just this crazy...
It's bizarre, but funny.
Yeah, it was in... But I do remember hearing that somebody had said, hey, Emo, so-and-so stole your joke. And in Emo's voice and in his mannerisms and ways, said, that's okay. And they go, what do you mean it's okay? He goes, it just makes me write faster. And I thought, okay, you know what? That's a very positive... I mean, you obviously don't want somebody to steal your jokes, but that's a very positive way of looking at it. All right, I'm going to throw three at you.
Before you throw three at me, somebody that I think is forgotten, but, well, maybe it isn't really a stand-up comic. I'm not really familiar, but in the golden age, Milton Berle.
Yeah. Well, Milton Berle was, if I'm not mistaken, he came out of more vaudeville, you know?
Correct.
I mean, again, this is one of those things where it's like...
I would compare probably Milton Berle a little more like Jackie Gleason.
Well, that's what I was saying is like, if we're talking pure stand-ups, and again, not that Jackie Gleason didn't do stand-up, he did, but that's not really what he was known for. Milton Berle did stand-up, but that's not necessarily what he was known for. Bob Hope did stand-up, but not necessarily what he was known for. The list goes on and on. Abbott and Costello, the Three Stooges, you know, Buster Keaton.
Oh, That's going to be a topic for another day, because I do have on my list Mount Rushmore of comedy duos.
Oh, God. I mean, you know, that in and of itself, you could have another day. Big fight over. You know, it doesn't include the silent stars like Chaplin. And that's why I said, like, if we're just taking this from right around when...
Buster Keaton
was the fucking man.
Yeah. Charlie Chaplin was great. But Buster Keaton is the unsung hero.
Totally. I mean, I think that Charlie Chaplin,
camera tricks.
Yeah.
Straight up. Holy crap.
He was a full-blown stuntman. He was a full-blown stuntman that just knew how to use his body humorously. Whereas Chaplin was the comedian. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He wasn't the stunt man. He learned how to do the stunts that he needed to do. He had the physicality. He was very, very physical his entire life. He was very, very athletic. Okay. But Buster Keaton was a whole different fucking animal as far as like, how big are your balls? You know what I mean? Yeah. Just stupid. And that's the thing, is you almost go, is he a genius or is he fucking stupid? Because
is he like a fox?
Yeah, like what is happening with that? Yeah, so that,
saw him do the traditional yoink, grabbing onto a moving train and letting his body flow with it.
Yeah, but if you look closely on that, you can see the wire lifting his body.
Well, yes, but okay. It's the idea.
But he still did it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, like
the clock thing.
The clock, the house falling, the front of the house falling or building.
That would never happen in a million years in today's Hollywood.
You're done. Forget about it, son. There's no two ways. All right. So we've talked about a lot of great comedians. There are three spectacular ones that I have not brought up yet. And again,
the shit you say,
the shit I say. We're going to go American, and then we're going to go with two from across the pond, one Scottish, and I believe the other is English. Mm-hmm. So the first one, Gary mm-hmm. Shandling.
Yes. Brilliant.
Just, I mean, look, we've talked a little bit about Roseanne Barr. We've talked a little bit about a lot of different comedians kind of that generation, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Roseanne, no matter what you think about her today, or what you thought about her back then. She did something that no one else had done.
True.
And did it brilliantly.
Very true.
Gary Shandling did that in a different way. Specifically when he did the Gary Shandling Show. That was, God, that was just a work of kind of behind the scenes, almost like an intro to reality TV in a way that I thought was absolutely brilliant. Billy Connolly. God, not only a brilliant comedian for decades. I mean, just like, I don't know anyone that has something really bad to say about
his storytelling. Is great. Great person. Saved the last season of Head of the Class.
Oh, absolutely. But here's a guy that I don't think has ever gotten enough love. Eddie Izzard. I think, yes. Eddie Izzard,
I think, makes other people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And a brilliant.
He did this one joke about, well, there's two that come to mind right out of the gate with Eddie. He's talking about Noah's Ark, and he's talking about, you know, everyone, let's go 2-2, 2-2. And the ducks and geese are like, nah, we're good. We're all right. We got this one. But the one that really always, there's so many, but the beekeeper joke. I want to keep bees. You know, I'll never forget what my dad used to say. Ah! Right? It's just like, you can't even think of the premise. Forget the punchline. You can't even think of the premise without laughing. And I think that was something that he was always really great at. So now, I mean, there's just so many comedians that I admire and I love their work and hope that if they're still living and still performing, nothing but the best for them. I have an admiration for the art in a way that not everyone does. My admiration is a little bit of historically and currently obsessive. I'm fascinated not just by the latest and greatest geniuses, but in awe of the guys that laid the groundwork ahead of time. So with
the road.
Yeah, they did. They paved the road. So with that, again, looking at the Mount Rushmore, it just kills me because I do think that I got to stick with Newhart, Lenny Bruce, Carlin, and Pryor. And I mean, like, there's names that we didn't even bring up, like, you know, David Brenner. I mean, like, there's just so many great comedians throughout the last 50 to, you know, 100 years. It's just a next to impossible task. But I'm going to do this a couple of different ways. I'm going to do what I think are the godfathers, the grandfathers, the historical powerhouses first. And that's going to be the Bob Newhart, Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, George Carlin. Now I'm going to switch it out. And I'm going to switch it out to women, because I don't think women get the love that they truly deserve as far as what they're doing with stand-up. And I'm going to go with the same period of time. Okay. And in that period of time, I'm going Moms Mabley, going.
And that is not a name that you hear people throw out.
No, but often. She really was unique and just,
if you're listening,
special.
Go look her up.
Yeah. She was just unique and special in her own way. I would go and now if I'm doing women from the point of view of just in general and not from a specific time period, that makes it a little bit more difficult. But if I'm doing the time period of basically the 60s touching into the 70s, I'm going to go Moms. I'm going to go Phyllis Diller. I'm going to go, let's see. God, it's so hard. Joan Rivers. And, God, it's very difficult to find the fourth in that particular time period. But, God, who would it be? Because
we didn't even mention, like, Felicia Michaels, name that most people have forgotten.
Oh, dude, and, Felicia was interesting.
I just had one. Victoria Jackson.
Oh, Victoria Jackson. Yes. Okay. So again, both of them unique in their own way. Victoria Jackson was, I mean, but then you could just go down with Victoria Jackson, you could just go down the rabbit hole of just phenomenal female SNL types. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's true.
So that's almost a whole different thing. I was trying to stay more to stand up, but I'm struggling to find another stand up that would fit into that time period. So for lack of a true stand up, but one of the most brilliantly funny women I think ever to walk the planet, and just a doll of a human being, Gilda Radner.
Mm.
So that would be
very good choice.
My Mount Rushmore for kind of that period of time. You know, late six, you know, going from mid 60s to mid 70s. If I'm going 80s, that's when you get your Eddie Murphy. That's when you get your Robin Williams. That's when you're going to get in the 80s. Let's see. You could go Kinison, because that was late 80s.
Yeah, late 80s.
And you could go Dice, late 80s. If you're going 90s, I think that you 100% got to go with Hicks. And quite frankly, Hicks, in my opinion, probably defined comedy from like 88, 89 until about 94, 95. And I think he still influences a lot of people. You know, and again, this is the part that bothers me, is I'm still leaving Steve Martin out of that. And that really bothers me, because I mean, he was just such a genius. Now, if you go into the 90s, in the 90s, obviously you're looking at Chris Rock,
Chappelle show.
Yeah. But that was more like, wasn't the Chappelle show like 98, 99,
94,
90. The Chappelle show was 94. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. 94, 95.
It was that long ago. Fuck. Oh. Well, I mean,
I believe so.
I don't think you can hold Chappelle just as Chappelle's show. I think Chappelle is like, if I'm talking about the Mount Rushmore of today, it's Louis C.K., Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock. And I got to be honest with you,
Oh my God.
What?
I am so wrong.
I thought you were.
It premiered in 2003.
Yeah, I thought that seemed odd.
My word.
If I'm going,
slap
like
my ass and call me sassy.
All right, sassy.
I was so wrong.
If I'm going like, you know, today, well, in the 90s, or, you know, the 90s, I would probably go Hicks, Mitch Hedberg. Those would be my two tops for the 90s. You could throw Gaffigan in there and Chris Rock. I think Chris Rock through the 90s, I think it would be Chris Rock, Bill Hicks, Mitch Hedberg, and probably Gaffigan in that time period. And again, I'm leaving Rickles out. I'm leaving some heavy hitters out. If we go like modern day, to me, modern day is going to be Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K. Those two are just hands down. Then I struggle a little bit, because I think you've got some really great contenders in modern day. I would say that you've got, like, obviously Kevin Hart, Bill Burr, but you could easily throw, you know, a Sarah Silverman and a Wanda Sykes in that.
The midget comedian, Brad. My God, what's his last name? Williams?
I'm not familiar.
What?
No, I'm not actually. I'm not familiar with. I probably, if I see him, I know. But again, like, I look at what Tom Segura is doing, and I think that what Tom Segura is doing is creeping up to being on par with like a Louis C.K.
Brad Williams.
Okay. All right. Yeah, but I wouldn't throw him in that bunch. So if we're talking today, I think I would be Chappelle, Louis C.K., Bill Burr, and, you know, like I said, I could kind of I could kind of go either way when it comes to, you know, like if I'm going to throw women on there, Sarah Silverman, Wanda Sykes, absolutely. If I'm looking at, you know, guys, I could go Gaffigan. You know, Amy Schumer, she's no slouch. She's out there. She
takes a lot of heat from, well, a certain demographic.
Yeah, but I mean, you also have guys like, you know, Nate Bargatze, who's killing it. You got guys like Birbiglia, who's killing it. Jimmy Carr's killing it. You know what I mean? Like, it becomes a very difficult final decision, but for the fourth. But my today, you know, in this generation, hands down, it would be Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K., Bill Burr, and I would probably say Tom Segura. I think that what those guys are bringing to the table today is some of the comedy that will stand the test of time, and they'll be remembered for it. It's not just going to be, oh, you did a special. It's going to be, oh, you did that bit and that bit and that bit. And each of those specials has 3, 4, 5 just marquee type bits. So that's where I would stand. You?
That's good. I think we could stick a bow on this, wrap it up, package.
And peace out. Done. All right. Sounds good. See you guys next time.
Toot-toot.